No response, sir. Sending again. Kathy Hobbs tried to raise the main recon drone once more. With one fraction of her mind, she watched the 50-second delay count tick off. With another, she followed the frantic shouting of the medtechs who were moving Master Pilot Joachim Marx to the sickbay. She watched through hallway cams. The man hung limp, arms adrift in the zero-G corridor Hobbs had cleared for the techs. He hadn't moved since the attack, or transmission, or whatever it had been. When the medtechs had first arrived, he hadn't even been breathing. In a corner of her vision, Hobbs saw Captain Zai flexing his fingers impatiently. But there was nothing she could do to increase the speed of light. The object was 25 light seconds away, and the recon drone's translight capability was definitely out. Before collapsing, the scout craft's sensory grid had taken a 200 exabyte input, the equivalent of a planetary array at full power, concentrated into an area 100 meters square. A hailstorm of information. The grid had perforated like tissue paper, but for those seconds, the drone had tried to pass on the information to the Lynx, and to its own pilot, and something bad had happened to Marx. "Do we have an origin for the attack, Executive Officer?"
"DA is trying, sir."
"A rough idea of direction?"
"Trying, sir."
Hobbs shunted another 10% of processor capacity to data analysis, forcing her to beggar the repair crews again. The captain's orders were coming fast and furious. With no determinations yet from any quarter, Zai's question spun from one issue to the next. Lost probes, an unconscious pilot. Was Marx dead, she wondered. A mysterious attack using radio, the huge and fantastic object of unknown purpose. Hobbs thought it unlikely that solid answers were coming any time soon. Tracking the source of the radio transmission was particularly tricky. The wave had been so focused that the Lynx's sensors hadn't caught a stray photon of it. Marx's numerous sub-drones had been too close together to triangulate. Directionality was impossible to determine. Hobbs watched the expert program she had assigned to find the transmission's source. It was requesting more flops, eating through the frigate's processor capacity like a brush fire. Unwieldy algorithms devoured their allotted phosphorus in seconds and screamed for more. Hobbs assigned more processors to the problem, but the calculation's duty slope remained hyperbolic, consuming her largesse in milliseconds. Hobbs queried the expert software's meta-software, which admitted that the entire Lynx's processors might be unequal to the task, even if they had years to get the answer. But it wasn't sure. The solution might come in a few more minutes, or perhaps in the lifetime of a star. Perhaps a little common sense was in order.
"Sir,
there's only one place in the system that could generate a transmission burst of that magnitude." Zai thought for a moment. "The Legis Interplanetary Array?" She nodded. "Raise the Imperial contingent there," he ordered. Hobbs tried, but nothing came back. She sent hails to the few Navy bases that were equipped with their own short-range entanglement grids. Again, nothing. The planet was offline.
"There is no translight response from Legis 15, sir. Zero."
"My God. What's our delay?"
8 hours one way, sir," she estimated.
The captain thought for a moment. During those seconds of silence, the medtechs reported to Hobbs that Marx was now breathing on his own. His brainwave diagnostics looked hot and unconscious, like a man in badly calibrated hypersleep. XO Hobbs noted that a marker in her vision was blinking, had been blinking for 15 seconds, and she flinched. She had missed the return point for the drone's message delay.
"Sir, the drones have failed to respond again. I'll try..."
Zai interrupted her. "Send a general order to all Lynx personnel on Legis via Lightspeed. I want a report on the planet's comm system status. And have DA monitor the civilian news feeds. See if anything's happening." Hobbs's fingers moved to comply with the orders, but faltered. She couldn't think of the protocol phrase for Zai's order. A report on the planet wouldn't make sense to the recipients unless they knew what was going on. They were Marines, not planetary liaisons. If they asked for clarification, 17 hours would be lost. In the meantime, a flurry of priority markers were flashing, repair crews demanding the return of their processor space. "You idiot, Kathy," she thought. She'd never freed the Lynx's computers from their potentially endless tracking calculations. The expert program was spinning its wheels while 100 other systems needed processor power. Her mind froze, overwhelmed for a few seconds. Hobbs realized that she was losing control. Her fingers would not move.
"One thing at a time," she commanded herself.
She released the processor capacity to repair, shot the Legis news feeds to a rating in data analysis, looked up at the captain, taking a moment to frame her thoughts. Marx is breathing, sir. The drones aren't responding to light-speed hails, and I think I may have reached task saturation. Her eyes dropped. She struggled to compose the captain's message to the Marines on Legis, realizing what she had admitted. But it was an absolute in her training. An executive officer must report her own failures as she would those of the crew. Hobbs felt the captain's hand on her shoulder. Easy, executive officer, he said. You're doing fine. She breathed slowly. Sai's hand stayed, offering its gentle pressure. Priority, priority, came a voice. Ensign Tyre. This had better be good, Hobbs answered. The young ensign spoke with absolute confidence. We've amplified the final signals from the recon drone satellite craft, ma'am. Hobbs's eyebrows raised. The smaller drones with Marx's craft had their own transmitters, but they were weak and light speed, intended to be relayed through the main recon drone. Hobbs couldn't remember if she'd ordered anyone to look for their transmissions. You have to see it, ma'am, Tyre said. It is priority, priority. I heard you, ensign. She ran Tyre's video in a corner of secondary sight, simultaneously scanning the Legis news feeds of 8 hours ago, Joachim Marx's diagnostics, and composing a message to the Marines on Legis. She kept this last simple. We can't raise the translite array. What the hell is going on down there? But through it all, Tyre's video caught her attention. What was that? She re-ran it, and felt her mind stuttering again. Captain.
Hobbs.
I need to show you something, sir, she managed. Hobbs cleared the big bridge airscreen. Only at that scale would anyone believe this. She played Tyre's video there, huge and undeniable. Floating before them was the object, rippling with the sharp lines of June shadows from the distant sun. Marx's crafts were a constellation around it. For a moment, the feed was perfectly clear, the images coming through the main drone. Then the radio burst killed it, and the detail on the object's surface disappeared. But the gross undulations of the object's perpetual sandstorm were still visible, caught by the sub-drones, which had apparently survived a few seconds longer. The object began to flex, to change shape. Is that a transmission artifact, Hobbs? Not according to DA, sir. This is at 1/10 speed, by the way. The boloid shape twisted, squeezing its own mass from one extremity into another, like some multi-chambered hourglass designed to record gravity shifts over time. It shot out geysers that plummeted back, still coherent, arches of running sand. The object's surface seemed abuzz with motion, covered with tiny explosions like an expanse of ocean in driving rain. Or perhaps it was forming fractal details that were lost in the low resolution. Then, just as the object's wild gyrations seemed to be subsiding, 16 clearly defined columns of sand shot out from it. Each targeted a separate drone, plucking them from space like hungry pseudopods, reeling them into the object's depths as the picture degraded stepwise, one drone dying after another into noise. Then the screen went dark. The bridge was silent, stunned. Executive officer, Sai's voice filled the quiet. Hobbs swallowed, wondering if she'd been foolish to have displayed this monstrous event to the entire bridge crew. Sir? Reset the repair priorities. Yes, sir. I want acceleration in 1 hour. That was utterly impossible, but Hobbs was too overwhelmed to protest. Yes, sir. Her fingers formed the necessary gestural commands. Somehow, the shock of what they'd just witnessed made it all easier. It was as if the troublesome higher functions of her brain, logic, comprehension, anxiety, had been erased by that mad and awesome image. All that remained of Hobbs was a smoothly functioning machine. But in some deep place she heard the screaming of her own fear, and the afterimage of the object's frenzy stayed frozen in her mind, like some troublesome burn-in of secondary sight that could not be erased. The thing had come to life. Fisherman. Another wave of torchfish struck him. The channel that joined bay and tide pool had become a torrent, the tide rolling wildly back and forth between the two bodies of water. Bright fish shot past him like grains of radium in some glowing hourglass. Joachim Marx looked up. The moon catapulted across the sky, sucking the oceans of the world along. Joachim plunged his spear into the sand and clung to it, fighting the current with all his strength. He couldn't remember which way the water was going, to bay or tidal pool. Both seem to have grown as vast as oceans, their shifting mass choking the raging channel in which Joachim found himself. He knew that he could not let go, couldn't let himself be pulled into the open sea. Marx looked down and saw a finger of red join the streaming darts of light. It was his own blood. The fish were biting him again. The traces of rushing light increased, multiplied, climbed an exponential slope. Joachim held on, screaming at the transient violations of small, sharp teeth. The gushing water pulled his spear into a hyperbole, lifting his bleeding feet from the sandy bottom. The sky was red, he saw. The ocean begged for him to let go. Its tidal strength stretched him out from the spear as if he were an arrow notched upon a bow. The ocean was full of a trillion tiny lights, a trillion voices and images and snatches of effluvial data. It raged with angry journal entries and impulsive cell orders and terrified calls to the police. The ocean wanted to consume him, to lose Joachim in its vast reservoirs of information. Joachim Marx felt his legs disappearing, shredded by the hungry, passing fish. His blood curled into the ocean, was turned on the lathe of its currents into a spiral jetty of red. But he held on. The torchfish had opened his gut and were nipping at his flailing entrails, carrying away his soft tissues like a furious wind stripping a dandelion. Bright bullets from some limitless firearm, the fish raked the flesh from his chest, pounded furiously at the insufficient armor of his ribs. They consumed Joachim's heart again. And finally, only his arms were left, then simply a pair of hands holding on with a ghastly singularity of will. But then the tide slackened. The torrent began to slow, and the spear unbent and lifted up its disembodied, defiant cargo. Joachim Marx felt himself coming back together. His arms grew from the indomitable hands, eyes and face beginning to reform, the wild scattering of his flesh and bones reversing. And he knew that by the time the moon would rise again, in a few minutes, he would be ready and whole. And the channel would rage at him again. Captain. What do we know about this object? Captain Lawrence Zai directed this question at Amanda Tyre. The young ensign held his eye steadily, he noticed. She no longer needed Hobbs as an intermediary. On a gross scale, sir, Tyre answered. Its volume changes constantly, but averages roughly 400,000 cubic kilometers. The outermost layer of sand spins about once every 6 hours, but like a star or a gas giant, different depths rotate at different rates. Its internal currents are far more variable than any natural phenomenon. Its motion is mathematically chaotic. I believe we had noticed that, ensign, Zai offered. What's it made of? Mostly empty space, sir. It would float in water, assuming it didn't saturate. No denser than a sugar cube. Zai noted that Tyre paused here, as if allowing for a moment of surprise, aware that her words unsettled the old psychological association between mass and power. Anything light couldn't hurt you. Based on the physical sampling affected by one of Marx's probes, most of the material content of the object is silicon. This silicon is saturated in units about a half millimeter across, the size of grains of sand. Each grain is composed of many extremely small layers and doped with various other elements.
Doped?
Yes, sir. Presumably to change the conductivity of the silicon, like the semiconductor materials in a pre-quantum computer.
Zai narrowed his eyes.
Tyre, do you think this object is one giant processor?
I don't know, sir.
She offered her ignorance without apology.
Zai was glad to see she was not a speculator, as so many in data analysis tended to be.
How does it move?
Before the transmission event, the motion was simply centrifugal, sir. The outer layer seems to be adhesive in some way, like a water droplet's surface tension.
Zai nodded. Everyone had noticed how much it looked like a champagne dervish.
But when the object consumed the recon drones, that movement was obviously some other process.
Obviously, Zai muttered. Any ideas?
I have suggestive data to relate, sir, and some possible interpretations to offer.
Please, Zai said, smiling. Perhaps Tyre was a speculator after all, but at least she was a cautious one. Tyre gestured, and the background radiation chromograph appeared in the command bridge's table airscreen.
This was recorded by the Lynx's passive sensors 12 minutes ago, a few seconds before the transmission event. That big spike is silicon. The smaller one up here is arsenic.
Arsenic?
So it could be a semiconducting processor, Hobbs said. Or at least a storage device. Zai nodded. Of that, he had grown fairly certain. He was waiting only for the civilian transmissions from Legius to confirm his fears.
Yes, ma'am, Tyre answered. It's a computer, but it's a great deal more.
She gestured, and the chromograph multiplied into a time series, propagating along its Z-axis to become a spiky, chaotic mountain range.
Here are the first few seconds of the transmission event. Note that the elemental makeup of the object changes.
Tyre leaned back from the table, folding her hands. Hobbs was the first to speak.
Changes? You mean to say it transubstantiated in a matter of seconds?
Zai looked at the air screen, trying to remember his stellar mechanics courses at the Academy. That was the last time anyone had asked him to interpret a chromograph.
What elements are we looking at? These spikes are metals, Tyre said, air-mousing a set of harmonics descending from the tallest peak. Vanadium, electrum, and titanium in correct proportions to create superplastic adamantum. And this is a bit of mercury, possibly for some sort of inertial guidance.
Guidance? Motile alloys? Zai said. This was too much to believe.
Yes, sir. The structures that plucked Marx's drones from space had to have some sort of orientation device and a powerful armature. The object's transubstantiation seems sophisticated enough to create such devices on the fly.
No, Hobbs said quietly. Zai narrowed his eyes. The Empire had transubstantiation devices. In industrial settings, lead could be turned to gold in useful quantities. Some isolated gas giant outposts with access to thermal energy sometimes made metals from hydrogen and methane. The process was obscenely energy expensive, but generally cheaper than shipping bulk materials in starships. And of course, there were always exotic new transuranium elements being created in laboratories. But this level of control, elements from across the periodic table on demand, was fantastic.
Why didn't we realize this sooner? Hobbs asked.
Tyre frowned.
We were too reliant on active sensors, ma'am. This process is more subtle than you'd think.
The ensign flicked her hand. Mass readings overlaid the chromograph, a set of lines alongside the mountain range as straight and parallel as maglev tracks.
As you can see, the silicon grains do not change mass when they transubstantiate. The object maintains a consistent density throughout, no matter what it appears to be made of. This elemental shift is somehow virtual. Of all our instruments, only the background radiation chromograph detected any change at all.
Virtual? Zai asked. How the hell can elements be virtual?
I don't know, sir.
Where is it getting the energy to make these changes? Hobbs asked. The object had no power source that they had detected.
I don't know, ma'am, but I don't think it takes much energy. In fact, it seems to be making more changes just now for no particular reason, as if it were flexing its muscles.
Pardon me? The static chromograph disappeared and was replaced by one in wild motion. The spikes jittered and jumped, animating the airscreen like the chatter of a crowd run through an audio visualizer.
This is real time minus light speed delay.
God, thought Zai. The thing was frantic. It pulsed and throbbed to wound the eyes. For a moment, Zai almost thought he saw a pattern in a dance of lines, as if some analog portion of his brain could grasp the internal logic of the thing's muscle flexing. He tore his eyes from it, but the afterimage rang in his mind. What had happened to Marx, he wondered. What had the patterns and logic of this thing done to the man? In the high-intensity synesthesia of a pilot's canopy, with his mind already weakened by hypersleep disruption, the master pilot would have been immensely vulnerable. Marx's brainwaves were active, obscenely so, but the man was still not awake.
What the hell are these? Hobbs said, interrupting Zai's thoughts.
The captain's eyes followed his XO's air mouse. A new range of mountains had appeared. Coded in blue, they jutted to the end of the air screen.
We believe that they're signatures of trans half-life elements.
Transuranium? Zai said, trying to bring the periodic table to mind.
Trans everything, Tyre said. Beyond our software, beyond even current theoretical speculation. We had to recalibrate just to differentiate them. There seems to be no upper limit to the number of electrons with which the object can endow its virtual elements. With no change in mass, without stability constraints, a half-life of forever.
The room exploded into chaos, scattering off into separate conversations. Everyone, it seemed, had been caught by these wild data, their minds taken over by the incredible implications of what they had seen. This had happened in the first Rick's incursion, back when Zai was a rating. The catapulting technologies of the Rick's never failed to amaze, to appall, to suggest whole new fields of inquiry. They could freeze the mind. Hobbs looked at him and pointed to the back of her wrist, an ancient Vaden hand sign he had taught her, suggesting that they move forward. Hobbs had already looked at the civilian transmissions from Legis, and from her prelim report, Zai's worst fears were likely to be realized. He cleared his throat. Amplified by the captain's direct channel, the sound silenced the command bridge. Let us look at the event from Legis's perspective. Hobbs took control of the air screen, clearing the wild gyrations of the object's dance. She divided the screen into three contemporaneous news feeds, all exactly 8 hours, 52 minutes prior to the transmission event. They had reached the links at light speed at almost the same moment the event had occurred. Zai moved his secondary hearing across them. A talking head disquisitioning on local politics, a sporting event, a financial feed giving raw data, undulating line graphs that showed price shift and volume. These are handheld channels, Hobbs explained, for watching on portable devices or in your head. They broadcast with satellite repeaters for maximum coverage outside of cabled areas. Crude, but strong enough for our passives to have picked up. She leaned back. The transmission event happens in 10 seconds. The bridge crew waited anxiously, transfixed by the banalities of local media. 5. Hobbs began to count down. At 0, all three of the pictures fractured. The talking heads of local politicians collapsed like faces in a shattering mirror. The image of the sporting event, some sort of obstacle soccer, froze, then horizontal jitters turned it into garbage. The financial channel was the most interesting. For a moment, the graph stayed coherent, but showed wildly shifting data as if some tremendous currency crash were underway. Then, like the others, the image collapsed into incomprehensibility. Well, said Hobbs, it appears as if... Wait! Zai silenced her. He gazed at the blur of the three screens. They hadn't snow crashed, hadn't reached a state of pure noise. There was a non-random signal there, an order in the chaos, like encrypted data viewed without the proper codes. The news feed's audio didn't sound like the undifferentiated wash of white noise. It was more animated, like the thunder of nearby traffic, a steady roar broken by individual vehicles passing, even the high-pitched bleat of warning horns. Tire, he ordered. Compare these transmissions to the chromograph data from the object. Compare them, sir? At an abstract level of organization, do they have comparable repeating features, similar periodicity? I don't need to know what they mean. Just tell me if there's any relationship. Yes, sir, Tyre answered. Her eyes dropped into the blankness of heavy second sight. Zai saw puzzlement on the faces of his staff, which flickered with the still coruscating lights of the Legis feeds. Obviously, whatever transmission hit Marx's drone struck the Legis infrastructure 8.5 hours prior, exactly the light-speed delay between the two, he said. Something hijacked their news nets and replaced their feeds, not with noise, but with pirate data. My guess is that the polar facility then repeated that data, sending it to the object. Marx just got in the way. But the facility was locked down, sir, the Marine sergeant complained. My troops were there at the pole. Zai frowned. The man was right. It was hard to believe that the Rick's compound mind could get past the physical keys of a locked-down translite entanglement facility. How had it managed that trick? Incoming messages, sir, Hobbs said. Lightspeed. The captain nodded. The information wake of the planet had finally caught up with them. Hobbs shut her eyes. From the polar array, she said. They're under attack, sir. Drones and autopiloted aircraft and a Rick's commando inside the wire. The Marine sergeant swore. He'd wanted to stay on Legis 15 to help track the Rick's woman down, but Zai had demanded he stay aboard the Lynx. A message from the palace contingent now. The breakdown is global. Every net-linked comm device is spewing garbage. Not garbage, Zai muttered. Information. The Rick's mind had managed to transmit something to the object. It had broken their blockade. From the pole again, Hobbs said, listening intently. They say the interplanetary array ramped up by itself, transmitting out of control. The Marine sergeant cursed again. What was its broadcast target? Zai demanded. Then he realized that with the translite facility disrupted, it would be 17 hours before any questions could travel round trip between the Lynx and Legis. Tyre, back from her data fugue, spoke up suddenly. You were right, sir.
There is a connection between the Legis data and the object. The ensign stared into her second sight, trying to translate the visuals there into words. There's a background period of 28 milliseconds in both, and some sort of utility pattern, 1,024 zeros in a row every few seconds. You were right. Zai felt no joy in this revelation. Now that information was rushing at them from every quarter, confirming his worst fears, he didn't know what to do. Despite all the Lynx had risked against the Rix battlecruiser, they'd been beaten. The compound mind had escaped their quarantine. "Something more from the palace, sir," Hobbs broke in. "The Marines say they've regained control of the security system. The comm breakdown seems to have confused the compound mind." Sai stared at her blank-faced. Ensign Tyre was speaking again. She related more information about the Legis feeds and the object. She had matched the common patterns to Marx's brainwaves now.
Damn, Zai thought.
Had he lost his master pilot to the abomination?
Sir, cried Hobbs.
Then she fell silent.
Report, Hobbs.
It seems the compound mind is gone, sir.
From the palace?
He asked. Hobbs shook her head.
From everywhere. The Legis nets are recovering, but the mind is gone, sir. Imperial shunts are taking over to prevent it from propagating again.
A comm officer added her voice.
I'm getting local militia transmissions on the emergency band. They're saying the same thing. Legis is free.
Zai sat back, shaking his head.
It's gone, sir, Hobbs said. Somehow we won. The compound mind is gone.
No, he said. It couldn't be this easy. A Rix mind couldn't be ousted by an infrastructure failure, no matter how drastic. There were no such miracles, no simple victories. No rest for Lawrence Zai. Then he saw it, realized what had happened. Zai's hands flicked in the air, bringing up the object's shape in the air screen.
It isn't gone.
He pointed at the twisting shape.
It's in there.
The staff stared into the air screen silently, as if hypnotized again by the undulations of the object. Tyre came out her fugue, nodding her head.
Yes, sir, it's in the object. I can see it there.
Engineer Frick,
Zai said.
Yes, sir.
Get me acceleration, he ordered, in 40 minutes.
But, sir, do it!
Lawrence Zai strode to the command bridge door. He needed to clear his head for a few moments to escape this surge of revelations.
How much acceleration, sir? Frick called after him. How many G's?
Wasn't it obvious, Zai thought.
Enough to ram that thing, the captain said, and left.
Marine Private First Class. On Legis, Marine Private First Class Sid Ackman despaired. Weary of trying to make himself understood, he made the signal for a global fall-prone order. As one, the militia soldiers dotting the icy hills around the target dropped to the ground.
A perfectly executed maneuver, Ackman thought sourly.
He had finally found something the Legis militia was good at. Cowering. When he'd first been assigned to Planetside, Private Ackman had been glad to escape the Lynx. The frigate had just received her orders to go after the Rix battlecruiser and figured to be a doomed ship. For a Marine, dirt was never a plum assignment, but it beat a cold death in space. But now the word was that the Lynx was doing fine, having bested the superior Rix craft on the first pass. And Private Sid Ackman found himself in perilous circumstances. As the Imperial Marine on the planet with the most actual combat experience, i.e. three drops, he was in command of this assault, which involved a hapless platoon of Legis militia closing in on an incomparably deadly Rix commando. The commando was cornered in her own lair, which she'd had weeks to prep defensively. In addition, her ice cave lay within 1 kilometer of the planet's magnetic north pole, and Legis's wild EM field was playing hell with the militia's gear. The thermal images were screwy, remote drones were useless, and the platoon's minesweeping robot would only walk in a giant lazy circle. A figure which the machine's internal nav insisted was a straight line. To make matters worse, PFC Ackman's heavy artillery support was non-functional. Something about the freezing cold. Therefore, Ackman's preferred strategy in this situation, quietly paint the target with X-ray lasers and have a flight of guided missiles launched from over the hill, was not going to happen. Air support was also out of the question. Some ghostly force had been attacking civilian aircraft around the pole for the last few weeks, and it was widely held in the militia command structure that the Rix compound mind could take control of anything in the air.
The militia bigs were very scared of the compound mine, even though it seemed to have disappeared during the big crash of a few hours ago. So they had electronically isolated this mission, even from the secure military infrastructure.